It is 50-50 football, 50-50 football on a Monday. Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons getting into the stories that count across the weekend, the ones that have stood out and grabbed our attention. John, what's grabbed us this week?
Well, Man City are first. I think they're just playing very well at the moment, and I think it's gone a bit unnoticed because of Chelsea are just relentless, and I think Guardiola's pointed that out himself and just said they just don't look like breaking. But I think it's worth noting, especially when you're talking about Guardiola's impact and looking forward, you know, to the project and what Man City are likely to do next year. I think their form is quite telling at the moment. And obviously they've still got quite a lot to play for as well. They're still in the FA Cup very much, and they've got a really big Champions League game coming up on Wednesday as well, which I think they'll end up going through in, but I think it might be another exciting one.
It will be another exciting one. So to start it off, from City Watch, we've got Hassan Naeem to join us to let us know what's happening with Manchester City, which is pretty exciting stuff. And we'll click all the links to where you can speak to him and hear his show and his contributors at the end of this show. And that'll all be there for you. But before then, we've got Hassan himself, and he is going to say hopefully positive things about Manchester City. It was an exciting win against Monaco. It's a solid win against Middlesbrough. You keep winning in the league. Is it all coming to the boil, Hassan?
Yes and no. I mean, we drew 0-0 with Stoke last week, which I think was a blow, because there was still the outside hope of the title, or at least for me. I'd kept at least one fire burning in the hope that we'd be able to...
Don't have to tell me about things like that, mate.
Yeah, I mean, you guys can relate to that, but I think the draw against Stoke last weekend basically put the final nail in the coffin of the title for City, so that was definitely disappointing. However, you're absolutely right. I think in general, over the last 2 months, the form has been quietly excellent, and the team is coming together. The style of play is coming together. You know, I think that's seven. I think we've broken our consecutive clean sheets away from home record, the club record, which pretty amazing for a team who apparently can't defend. So yeah, no, I mean, happy. Not obviously, I'm not going to be over the moon because we want to win the title every season. So, and not feeling like we're in that title race now, it stings. But beyond that, yeah, the Champions League looks exciting. We're still in the FA Cup. Yeah, no, things are definitely coming together. Looking forward to the summer transfer window as well.
I think what's also must be nice to Man City fans is the emergence of certain players over the second half of the season that are going to be big players for you in the years to come. So it's not just kind of the old guard having a bit of a last one swan song. It's guys that you can generally get excited about. Raheem Sterling's form has been very good. I've been impressed with Sane, who was maybe a little bit slow starter, understandably. But Sane's looked good for me since Christmas. And there's obviously Jesus as well, who's been injured, which, you know, must be very upsetting for Manchester City fans just because they just want to watch him play. But,
yeah,
you know, but those three, I mean, you're talking about attacking talent for 10 years, never mind five.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think the standout, to be honest, has been Leroy, because he looks the absolute real deal. And you're right, Raheem's been quietly been arguably our player of the season in terms of consistency. But if you were to look back over the last sort of 6-8 weeks, it's the emergence of Sane that has changed the dynamic of the side, because now suddenly you've got Raz on one wing and you've got Leroy on the other, and that it just changes the entire complexion for the opposition. I think that you see it when the two of them are playing, no matter who we play, whether it's a top team or it's a mid-table team, when both of those guys are playing, the opposition are shit scared. Can I swear?
Is that
yeah,
right?
That's fine. Sound.
Fill your boots.
Okay, sound, yeah. No, we look like we're putting the fear of God inside when those two play, and I like that. And the fact that they're so young, yeah, I mean, it's not just about this season, it's about the next 5 or 10 years.
On that as well, the other thing I've noticed is how much they actually seem to link up with each other or be in the same patterns of play with each other. It isn't as simple as them both being in wide areas, is it? They're very much sort of, they're both tuck in, they both feel as though they've got the freedom to come central and play a little bit. And I think that, you know, that reminds me of an old style sort of Chelsea with Robin and Duff, or United when they had Rooney, Ronaldo and Tevez. You know, it's got that, it's much more of the idea that it's a forward three, not the idea that there's one lad who's playing centre forward and the other two are sort of just gonna have chalk on their boots and they're not there to do anything else. And you've seen the goal return from the pair of them as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's about the positions that they're taking up. I think actually what I think is quite interesting is that more often than not, when one of those lads gets to the byline and looks to whip the ball across, it's generally his wing partner on the other side who's coming around the back for a tap-in, and Aguero or whoever's playing centre-forward is normally just off, normally just 2 or 3 or 4 yards back. So, yeah, no, there's very much, you very much feel like you're playing with three out-and-out forwards in a way. I think the other thing is that they're big mates off the pitch as well, and you can see that there's a chemistry between the two of them that they bring onto the pitch. And again, I mean, these are all little things, but when you put them together, it makes them a very, very difficult pair of players to deal with.
I think they're the things that definitely add up and the things that, you know, can make a massive difference. And the shame, really, from a City point of view, it's not just watching him, is that Jesus isn't there to sort of be part of that at this stage. You know, it's not to, I want to talk about Aguero in a second, but with an eye on sort of developing into next season, the idea that there's the three of them playing together every week could only have helped. Aguero's obviously doing a decent job, but it would have been good to sort of get that front three and, as you say, have them be three forwards, but three forwards who all interlink, who all work together and who all play as forwards and all expect to get goals. Would have been a bit better for City, even if maybe, you know, the results haven't been quite as good, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, without question. Look, I think that the little glimpses that we saw of Jesus, the thing that stood out the most is that he brings an intensity to his game and also an intelligence in terms of the team ethic, which fits perfectly with what Sterling and Sané do, and it's natural for him. So when the three of them play together, I can understand why Guardiola watched the three of them play together and immediately dropped Aguero. And that's no criticism of Aguero or slight on his ability. It's just that the three of them together, again, one, it's about chemistry. You can feel that the three of them in that short space of time had chemistry. And secondly, Jesus is much closer to Sterling or Sané in the way that he plays and the way that he kind of, you know, he's a centre forward, but he's not your traditional number nine in the sense that he's not greedy for goals. He's a goal scorer and he wants to score goals, but he's not greedy for goals. When he's up there, it's about the team. It's about making sure that somebody scores when he's in that position. And if he can lay an assist on, for example, in the first game or the second game that he starts, he lays an assist on for De Bruyne with a first-time pass from a position within which 90% of the centre-forwards, if they were to collect a ball in that position, they just would never think about playing a pass, let alone playing a first-time pass into the path of a midfielder. They'd always be thinking about scoring themselves. And that's the key with Jesus, that he's come in and he's got that headspace of, yeah, I want to score goals, but I want to lay goals on for my mates as well. And I think that's Pep loves that, and that's probably the root of why Aguero found himself out of the team so quickly.
On Aguero, though, what he has done is he's not let it affect him. He's not let his head go down. He keeps working. You know, he doesn't look like he feels as though he's not part of proceedings, which I think speaks of a strong group and speaks well of the manager as well. You know, it would be quite easy, and the player, you know, it'd be quite easy for everyone, one way or another, to take the toys home off this before the Jesus injury. And instead, that's what hasn't happened. And instead, Aguero now, if anything, looks sharper than he did at the start of the season.
Oh, without question. I think I'd go so far as to say that maybe Aguero looks, in terms of his hunger to play and his appetite for the game when he's on the pitch, I'd say he probably looks as intense and as hungry as he ever has in a City shirt. And yeah, absolutely, that's a credit to the way that Guardiola has managed a situation which could have gone the other way. to credit to Aguero. But then again, his professionalism throughout his entire time at City has been really, it's been untouchable. So in that sense, it's not that much of a surprise to see him reacting in the way that he has reacted. I'll be honest, though, I wasn't sure, like, when it happened, just purely from a supporter's point of view, I felt the sting that Aguero would feel when he was benched for Jesus. And that's me talking as a massive fan of Jesus as well. But we know what Aguero's done for us in the past, and we know what a talented player he is. So it's, you know, it would have been the equivalent of a manager coming in and benching Suarez or somebody like that, just coming in and going, you know what, I've got this young kid, so Suarez, you're going to sit on the bench. That's, no matter what you, no matter how good the player is that's coming in, you can't help but look at the player sat on the bench and feel for him. And so, yeah, I felt as though it really had the potential to go tits up. And I think it speaks volumes of the professionalism, as I say, of Aguero, and also just the way that Pep's handled it.
Well, on that, you know, the handling thing as well, you can actually make that, you know, make the same point around the Yaya Toure thing, which for a while looked like it was going to become this massive intractable thing for City. And yet Pep Guardiola, again, in conjunction with the footballer himself, who also deserves praise, certainly as a man who sometimes gets mocked over things like, they didn't do anything nice for my birthday, and all of that sort of thing, that, you know, the very, he's knuckled down. It's not a role he's, you know, he's accustomed to playing that much. He's, you know, he's moved all the way through the spine of the team, through his career or wherever he's been, Yaya Toure. But he's doing a good job for Manchester City. He's doing a good job for himself as a professional, a good job for his teammates. It's a relatively unselfish job as well. And he's just knuckled down as well. And again, that speaks a credit to everyone's situation.
Absolutely. Look, I think it's wider than that, Neil. I think that we've got six players out of contract this summer, and some of those players are playing regularly right now. So, you know, Sanya or Zabaleta, who are both out of contract, playing every week. Clichy, who's out of contract, is playing every week. Toure, who's out of contract, is playing every week. Caballero, who's out of contract, is playing every week. I think it speaks volumes that Guardiola, not just with Toure, but with all of these players who are out of contract, has got them motivated in a manner where, I'll be really honest, that I felt as though that was a disaster waiting to happen, so many players being out of contract this summer, because I felt as though if the title goes, we feel like we're too far away from the title, this lot aren't going to be asked anymore. And I think, again, it's a credit to Guardiola, it's a credit to the way that he's handled the group, that every week these players are being asked, what about your contract? And every week these players are saying, listen, the only thing I'm interested in is winning things with Man City this season. The contract will take care of itself when the summer arrives. So, yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to what Pep's done. And with Toure, he's rolled back the years. He really has. Again, he looks fitter than he has done in 18 months, 2 years. But again, that extends to the group as a whole. I think quietly, if you look across the side, you know, everybody's improved. Kolarov's a better defender than he was a year ago. Toure's a better player. Sterling's a better player. Fernandinho's a better player. Zabaleta looks a better player. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about really young players, players at the end of their career, or players who maybe just need to move on. All of these players who are playing, they look improved. And I think you guys will know from having a similar experience with Klopp that, you know, when a new manager comes in a way, in that first 12 months, that's kind of the most gratifying thing, is when you start looking at players who you maybe previously thought, I'm not sure he's got a future at the club. And then suddenly you're looking at them perform at a level that you've never seen them perform at, and you're going, hold on, maybe I got these players wrong.
When you're naming all those players there and you're naming those lads who are out of contract, it is, you said before, it's going to be an interesting summer. And I think as football supporters, when we think about an interesting summer, we very much think about the lads who are coming in. But looking right the way through that City squad, including who's on loan, you know, I'm going to list a series of players here, some of which you already listed, but it wouldn't surprise if any of these left. Caballero, Clichy, Otamendi, Kolarov, Company, Mangala, Sanya, Zabaleta, Delph, Fernando, Nasri, Navas, Silva, Toure, Boney and Nolito, because Nolito's opportunities have become fewer and furthest between as the season's wore on. And that's quite a, you know, it's when you're talking about the summer, you know, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? It really could be a profoundly different Manchester City that we're looking at next season.
Absolutely. I think just before I start on that, did you say Silva? David Silva's not going anywhere.
Don't you think so?
No chance. He's been. If Raheem hasn't been our player of the season, then David Silva's been our player of the season so far. And I think that I read a quote from Guardiola a day or two ago, basically saying that David Silva's got what Philip Lahm's got, what Xabi Alonso's got. He's one of the smartest footballers he's ever worked with, and he's one of the reasons that he wanted to come and coach at Man City was because David Silva was here. Now, there might be an element of lip service within that, but there's just, for me, Silva's not going anywhere. With everybody else who you've just listed, absolutely, there's a question mark. At the bare minimum, there's a question mark above their name, and with some of them, you think for sure they're gone. I think that there is going to be a churn, Neil. I think that the key thing, though, is that you can kind of see, you can see the roots taking hold within the best 11, the best 14 of the way Guardiola wants to play and where certain players do or don't fit in. And I think it'll be easier for him and easier for the transfer team this summer than it was last summer, because I think last summer there was the tournament, and I think when you've got a big international tournament summer, it's difficult to get deals done. It's difficult to get deals done early. It makes everything very complicated. I think this summer, the fact that there isn't a summer tournament and the fact that Guardiola's had an entire season to look at everybody, I think it'll be a lot easier and a lot smoother, and it'll feel a lot less disruptive this summer, even if we may end up with more players leaving and more players coming in than last summer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in terms of players coming in as well, I'm sure he'll be having a look at the youth teams and how well they're doing. And it's something that we've spoke about a little bit privately, Hassan, but, you know, the youth team set up at Man City is absolutely fantastic. They're managing to attract the best players because of what they're able to offer. And also, you know, you look at the results they're getting. I noticed last week in the FA Youth Cup semi-final, they won 6-0. I mean, you shouldn't be winning semi-final 6-0, but Man City are. And I guess the whole point of this is developed players for Man City's first team, or kind of what's the point. And so they must be thinking, I'm sure they'll strengthen, I'm sure they'll spend money, and I'm sure they'll look for proven quality in certain areas. But I wonder whether between now and the end of the season, if they can get top four sewn up, and especially if they're still going in the Champions League, then you might see maybe two or three more be given a bit more of a go, just so we can have a look at them and see if there are options for them next year as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's been a difficult on that front, it's been a difficult season as a supporter, because I think we all came into the season expecting a lot more young players to have been given a lot more minutes than they have been given. On that front, so far it's been a disappointment. I completely agree with what will happen this summer. I think Pep's already said that of the under-18s of the current, that youth cup side, there's actually three or four players in that side who Pep has said that he wants, that will definitely be going on the pre-season tour, and who will have a shot at the first team.
Who's that
next season? So I would say the three that are dead certs would be Phil Foden, Brahim Diaz, and Jadon Sancho. So those three are the most talented in that youth side by some distance. Phil Foden has been talked about as the most talented player in England, full stop, in that age group.
Yeah.
So those three I would expect to be given a big chance this summer. And then from there, we will see if they next season are involved with the first team. There's two more. There's Pablo Maffeo, who's out on loan at Girona. Now, Girona are about to be promoted to La Liga. I was really, really surprised that Maffeo wasn't given more of a chance this season, considering Sanya and considering the age of Sanya and Zabaleta. And it made me begin to think, oh, maybe Guardiola doesn't fancy him, and that's why he's not been given a chance. But again, in the last week or so, quotes have come out of Spain with Guardiola saying, no, with Maffeo, the only thing was, I know his quality and his talent, the only thing was, it would have been disrespectful to Sanya or Zabaleta, since they both stayed at the club, to have one of them drop below Maffeo in the pecking order. So I would presume that Maffeo comes back and definitely next season is in contention for the right back spot. So those are the four obvious ones. There's Sancho, Foden, and Diaz, who are in the EDS right now, and there's Maffeo, who's out on loan at Girona. Those are the four who I think have got a fantastic shot at the first team for next season.
Before we let you go, one more little thing is the matter of Monaco coming this week. It's, you know, the 5-3 lead. Guardiola's right to point out it's perfectly conceivable Manchester City could get beat 2-0 or 3-1. But it's an exciting opportunity, I'd say, from the outside looking in. I think for the first time in a while, this is a, you know, it looks like a European Cup, which could Champions League, which could go in, you know, it could go to a variety of different places.
Yeah, it doesn't
places.
Look sewn up, does it?
No, it doesn't look, it's not as though you're looking, there isn't a side who you go, they're the team to beat, John. Yeah. And in years gone by, that's been the case, even if they have somehow, someone has managed to beat them. And it doesn't quite look as though, for the first time in a while, even though they may well still all get to the semis, but Real Madrid, Barcelona and Bayern Munich look a million miles away from everybody else either. And so, you know, what I'm sort of asking you, Hassan, round the houses, is a Manchester City supporters stopping and having a face on about the European Cup and getting stuck in and enjoying it a bit more than given these opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I think
you're going to pack and boo in that anthem.
No, I mean, it's a debate that we've done to death on our podcast and on Twitter. And the truth is that I don't boo it, but I know enough people who I respect as supporters who say they'll always boo that anthem. I think you guys laugh, but it's, you know, there's some things that stick in the throat that won't go away. And it is things like, you know, City being fined more money for coming out onto the pitch 30 seconds late than Porto got fined for their supporters racially abusing Mario Balotelli in the same game. So in the same game, you've got supporters that are making monkey chants at Mario. And the fine that Porto get for that is less than the fine that City get for coming out on the pitch.
Yeah, 30 seconds.
So stuff like that, you know, is the problem is that with the financial fair play sanctions, and when financial fair play came in, a lot of intelligent supporters decided to take a magnifying glass to UEFA. And you guys know that these football governing bodies, they're, you know, they're bent as fuck, man. So within that respect, it's supporters, our lot are going to boo that anthem. Having said that, the competition itself, oh no, they, you know, you, when you feel you can win a competition, you like that competition. And I think that quietly City fans feel like, with Guardiola in charge, with the players that we've got, maybe it won't happen this season, but we're going to win this European Cup soon enough. We're definitely far more behind it than we have been previously, even if we are going to boo that silly anthem.
Great stuff. When it gets everyone going, anything that gets everyone all riled up, so I think probably a positive.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you know what? That's exactly the argument that somebody used with me last week, because we're arguing about the booing this anthem very regularly right now. And somebody said to me, they said, listen, the atmosphere's better, we boo it, and that sort of, that friction that is there, it gets the crowd going. We boo it until it's over, and as soon as it's over, that energy is put into getting behind the team. So I can't argue with that.
Prediction for this game midweek, just out of interest?
Oh, what, the Monaco game?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I've got no idea. I'll be really honest with you. I think it'll be a high-scoring game, and I think that City will manage to get through into the next round. But, you know, for example, I can see it finishing 2-2 or 3-3, something mad like that.
Okay. European football is not what it used to be. Huge thank you to Hassan. We're going to shift over now from Manchester City to Spurs to Martin Cloke to talk about Tottenham Hotspur and to talk about a season, Martin, that I think, trying to find the right way to phrase it, really, I've been talking around it recently, and it's not just one season, I'd say it's possibly two. Tottenham could do with a trophy. I get the impression from the outside looking in that it, and possibly, and you've got to be careful around the use of this word in football, but possibly Tottenham may well deserve a trophy, and the only one that's left for them this campaign is the FA Cup. They get themselves into the semi-finals midweek. Is that fair, do you think?
I don't think publicly I can write off the Premier League title, but it could be a tough one. Well, with the Chelsea to slip up, so I'll get that one in quickly. I think a lot of the conversation among Spurs fans has been that, and I think that's the general observation, that it's partly to do with Spurs, who often have shown promise, and that promise hasn't got to anything for quite some time. But I think it's an observation that, you know, pundits and supporters of other clubs have made as well, that there's a lot of good things. It's been very, very enjoyable watching this team for the past couple of seasons, really since Pochettino came in. You know, for lots of reasons, the style of football, the development of the homegrown players, and the honesty about it as well, that, you know, we feel as if the club's got an identity back in an era where, you know, often it's big brands, and there's a kind of a sense of entitlement, I think, amongst a lot of supporters of the so-called big clubs as well. So I think that we feel that you know, there's something very special there. I mean, I'm giving my age away, but I've not enjoyed watching the team as much since I watched the Spurs team of the early 80s, people like Perryman, Hoddle and Ardiles, Tony Galvin, all of that lot as well. So, we definitely need a trophy. I think, you know, from a professional point of view, you know, Pochettino certainly has been a promising manager with a number of teams for a while, and he needs now to win something, because the point of the game is winning trophies. The only reason I'm a bit hesitant about, it's always difficult, and I think I mentioned the sense of entitlement before when we're talking about need a trophy or whatever. The point of the game is to win things, but, you know, if you talk about needing things, you know, Leighton Orient needs their club to be run properly. Yeah. Blackburn Rovers need their club to be run properly. So, you know, we're doing pretty well here, and I think, you know, it's a little bit like difficult to do it without particularly having a dig at the Arsenal fans, because I can see fans always have a right to question where their club's going. But when you see Arsenal fans after what they've had the last 20 years talking about their manager killing their club, that's kind of why I'm a bit careful about saying, you know, we need or we're entitled to or we deserve, because there are so many clubs that would love to be in the position that we're in as well. You know, but that said, you've got to have that edge and you've got to want to be a winner. And I think if we come out of this season without anything to show for it, then you know, it will present problems potentially in terms of holding on to people, but people will start asking the questions that it's been one of the best teams to watch certainly in the Premier League for the past couple of seasons, and you need to have something to show for that. You know, it's nice to be entertained, that's what we go along for, but it is, I think, as I've said probably too many times in that extended monologue, it's about winning things.
You say about how much the supporters are enjoying it, but the players really seem to be enjoying it as well, and that's important, especially, you know, as of what you've just talked about, which is keeping hold of them. You don't really get the impression anymore that Manchester United can just come along and take your best player like they seem to do every summer for about 3 years. And I think, you know, we can all laugh at Dele Alli and Harry Kane and the silly handshake and things like that, but if you are Kane, you would think about twice about going, because, you know, the guys behind you are supplying you with such good balls, and the fact that they just seem to be enjoying the football and enjoying each other's company, and they all speak very highly of their manager, and every time I look on the BBC website there seems to be a new Spurs player signing a new contract, which is, you know, a great sign as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the team spirit is one of the things that, you know, it floats through to the fans in the stands as well. It's very enjoyable to watch, and what it's hard, because I think, you know, you've sort of been supporting any team for a while, you get very cynical about saying, oh, you know, this player's totally committed or whatever, because in the end it's a business and people will go and do what they think is good for them professionally. But what I would like to think is that it's a group of players who see that they've built something. And I think, you know, they could, let's be honest, you know, Harry Kane or Dele Alli could be offered far more money by Manchester United or Liverpool or Real Madrid or whoever. But you would like to think that what they'd say is, well, okay, I can go and, you know, I'll get a transfer to Real Madrid, I'll drop into that team, I'm expected to win, and if we don't win, then, you know, there's a problem there. Same goes for the manager. If the manager gets poked by PSG or Real Madrid or anybody like that, you know, winning is what's expected. if you stay at Spurs and you build something and you become the first Spurs team to win a title, you know, since 1961, or the first Spurs team to win a cup, you know, for many, many years, then you become part of history as something special. And it's something you've built yourself. And what you would hope is that as a professional, people would, you know, they look at, you know, what's the best career move, what's the best, you know, wage earning potentially as well. But you would think achieving something would be that on that list if you're a professional, you know, so achieving something that you built yourself. And that, you know, the potential there is to say, oh, you know, it's a fairly naive, idealistic thing for to say. And to an extent it is, but that's part of the magic that we like about the game as well, isn't it? So wanting to believe those players want to do that. But I think there can be a little bit of a hard-headed analysis there and say, surely it's better to look back and say, you know, we built so. I thought this when we sold, it's in different times when we sold Berbatov to Manchester United a few years ago. And, you know, who knows what the discussions were that went on in the boardroom, but I wanted to be able to say to Berbatov, yeah, you can go to United, but if you stay at Spurs and you help us win the title, then you're going to be a legend. Your name's up there forever. He went to United. He was the top scorer and the top assist provider in the season. They won the Premier League title, and they never really took to him. So, you know, I mean, maybe he's regretting it, maybe he's not. But it's that kind of mix of romanticism and hard-headedness. But I think there's maybe something in that.
Moving on to sort of a key aspect of that, really, someone who doesn't like he's going anywhere for a period of time, but could be missing now at a pretty key moment of the season in Kane. It's, I don't want to sort of insinuate that Spurs are a one-man team because it's nonsense, but it is fair to say that he makes a massive difference to Spurs when he plays. We saw it earlier in the season. You know, it's so tough to play centre-forward in this league in general, and you see Son cut loose against Millwall there yesterday, but, you know, you've seen him struggle with the physical challenge of the Premier League. I'm get buffeted from here to there, which doesn't happen to Kane. If he is out for 6 to 8 weeks, it will make matters significantly tougher for Spurs, won't it?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you've got a player of the quality of Kane inside and you're missing him, then obviously it's a problem. I think, you know, you look at any side's key player, you know, you can't replace them. And we've got, you know, arguably Danny Rose being out, who I think is the best left-back in Europe, without any shadow of a doubt. Ben Davies is a very, very able deputy, but Ben Davies' problem is that he's not Danny Rose. And you can't
completely
replace Danny Rose. And that's it. So you've got the same thing with Kane. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because what we've got now, and I've seen, obviously, you know, since yesterday, you know, the kind of press coverage and the various kind of comment on the message boards is building up. And Kane, who was somebody who, for different reasons, you know, some of it was club rivalry and some of it was, you know, whatever you care to ascribe it to, Kane was overrated. He's not really a world-class player. He's a tapping merchant at the end. He scores penalties. He's not really that good. Now, I think, again, you look at the guy's goal-scoring record over the past three seasons, he is one of the top strikers in Europe. Absolutely no question about that. Now he's out, suddenly he's brilliant, and it's a complete disaster, and, you know, our season's going to be over. And I said, obviously, it's going to have an effect on us, because of the way the team plays and because of the influence he has, not just his technical ability and his goal scoring, but his personality on the pitch. I mean, he leads that team, I think, and he brings people in and he brings people around him. But suddenly, now he's out, we're, you know, the recognition that he's that good is there. So it's a bit of an irony in there as well.
Yeah.
You know, in the bitterness of seeing him kind of hobbling out of White Hart Lane on crutches and with his foot in a cast.
Yep, I think I agree with you. No.
Maybe Vincent will do the job now. He got a great goal yesterday, didn't he? So you never know.
No, I mean,
in the first season, everybody was writing Eric Lamela off, and then suddenly, you know, in the first half of this season, he was one of our most influential players. So sometimes you need to give players a little bit of a chance. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. But
I think it's the difference between the idea of being a one-man team and being a key player, and I think you put that over quite well, because I completely agree with you on Danny Rose. I think that, for instance, one of the reasons why Liverpool had success against Spurs at Anfield was Ben Davies. Ben Davies is not a bad player, he's a good player, but when you play the way in which Tottenham play, which is with so much intensity, well, everyone across the 11 becomes a key player, if you know what I mean. If one of them's missing, because it is quite a finely tuned machine, it does make it difficult, and I think that's what, you know, where the Kane being out can be a problem, is because he, you know, he's able to sort of occupy almost two positions at once, the way in which he plays and the fact that he can take the physical punishment on the one hand and he brings people into the game in the other. And in that's likely to, you know, be the thing that makes it difficult. But it was interesting how strong a side the manager went with against Millwall. Again, coming back to the idea that I think all the sides have chopped and changed this season, but now it's the quarterfinals. It's serious stuff. And I think that it is serious stuff for Spurs now. And you could just see that with the fact that he picked his first choice back three, all of whom have been so impressive this season.
Absolutely. And I think he's kind of crossed a bit of a line there as well, because there was a little bit of a rumble. There was criticism amongst Spurs fans of Pochettino. It was that he didn't seem to take the cup seriously. And we haven't, I'll admit that when I saw the starting lineup yesterday, I thought I would prefer us to put our strongest 11 out, and it wasn't our strongest 11. You know, we've got a week until the next game. There's no reason not to do that. Millwall, I thought, would give us a bit more of a game than they did. You know, they've had this 9.5 hours without conceding, you know, this long unbeaten run as well. And I think they'll be disappointed with the performance that they put in yesterday. But looking at it from the other side, you have the argument about, you know, does rotation work? Son, Form, Trippier and Winks have started all of the cup games. And what you saw yesterday was the result of the experience that they've had in those games, in proper games with a competitive edge. They're coming into a unit. And I think the argument about rotation goes down to how far can you rotate without unbalancing the unit? You've got 11 people that have not really played together as a unit before. There's going to be an issue, no matter how good they are. And what we saw yesterday, I mean, it was a very, very, very good performance, admittedly against poor opposition, but it was a very, very good performance by Spurs, the way that we moved the ball around. And I've watched them for years, you know, before Pochettino came along. And one of the biggest sources of frustration, you know, among the many, we probably haven't got long enough to go into all of them on this, but was that we never had options before. And every time a Spurs player's got the ball now, there are one or two options, at least, as a passing opportunity for them as well. And that's a real difference. The way that we move the ball around the pitch, I think, is one of the things that's really good to watch about us. But that means that you need that unit working together. Every player needs to know what their colleague's going to do, where to move, what options to give them, where they're going to be looking. And that's, to me, that's the way football should be played.
Lastly then, before we let you go, Martin, just wanted to, well, in fact, no, not second to lastly, actually, just wanted to touch on the what felt, and you were obviously much more in the thick of it than I was, but what felt like a media desire, really, to see there be some sort of trouble at Spurs Millwall yesterday. I was, you know, all the way through the week, it did feel as though a lot of the reportage was very much, you know, the idea of, oh, it's all going to go off here, it's all going to be very awkward, very, very difficult. Did you get that sense of it as well?
I think obviously it was a high risk fixture. There's a little bit of a history between the two sets of fans, and there was a very, very obvious police operation. It they were out in much more force probably than they have been in the game that I can remember for quite some time. I thought that it might end up being hyped up more. There's a little bit of hype. I mean, in the era of message boards, you know, and fake news and whatever, you never quite know what to believe. So there's a lot of talk going around before the game. There were a few articles in the press that seemed to play things up a little bit, but some of that was a lack of understanding. I mean, one of the things I do, I co-chair our supporters trust, and we were invited along with some Millwall fanlets to go along to a meeting with the police last week ahead of the game to talk about, you know, various things that happened, what information, if we go out to fans, we get a chance to put our own questions in as well. So a few people from the press got in touch and said, obviously this has been called, you know, because there's a chance of trouble. And he said, well, no, actually, we go to these meetings before every London derby,
yeah,
you know, before any game that it isn't just a kind of a by-the-by game. There's always a meeting. And it's something that the Football Supporters Federation have been pressing for quite a long time. And quite a lot of the fan groups across the country go along. You know, if Liverpool play Manchester United,
yeah, we have them, yeah,
for example, then the fan reps go along to that as well. So some of it is almost educating the press and saying, actually, this thing that looks as if at first glance to be, you know, because there's likely to be a problem, is actually fairly routine. So I think we managed to get across the message that, you know, a lot of it was routine. The police's approach was they wanted to talk to me about football. Largely it has. I think you've got to be sensible as well. And, you know, there are some matches which are higher risk than others. And this was a Category C IR, which is an increased risk game. But again, Category C IR, you know, the press gets very excited. Oh, increased risk, that means that it must be a real problem. Well, actually, that categorisation is given to quite a few games in the English football calendar as well. So, you know, and you know what it's like, you know, football fans, sometimes we can be our own worst enemies, but also I think we're given sort of less of an opportunity to, you know, sort of than other sets of supporters or other people. People are always assuming that, you know, this association between football fans and hooligans is still a difficult one to break. But it all seemed to go off pretty well yesterday. I think there were only two arrests in the end, which is, you know, probably, you know, less than quite a few other games as well. And it was, you know, there was a bit of an aggressive edge, and some of it was a little bit unpleasant in terms of getting in and out of the ground and police lines and, you know, sort of people gesticulating at each other. But you usually find, especially around grounds, a lot of these things are people jumping up and down and filming each other on their phones and sort of putting it around on social media. So, you know, I don't, as far as I know, there wasn't really any significant problem.
All right, just to finish off then with the league season, you say you're not giving up chasing Chelsea, which should sort of be the answer to my question, really. It's one which, on the one hand, could go either way, but on the other hand, I would say we're 28 games in and Spurs have been one of the best four teams in the country. I think it's difficult to dispute that. Arsenal and United are the only two sides who I think you've got left to play who would also fall into the category of competing for the right to call themselves one of the best four sides in the country. There's nothing to be scared of in either of those fixtures. It's the expectation that this is the season that you're firstly going to finish ahead of Arsenal, but secondly, obviously, cement yourself back in the top four?
I think cementing yourself in the back four, I mean, you know, you kind of get into the bluff and double bluff with a finish above Arsenal. There, it's always good to finish above your rivals. I mean, we've got this long record of, you know, not having finished above them for, what is it, you know, I'm not even going to try to remember how many years because it's too depressing. So it'd be great, but I think us cementing ourselves in the top four is very, very important in terms of keeping hold of that squad and keeping hold of the manager. And also, I suppose it's back to the word that we used right at the start, isn't it, that it's about deserve. But then, you know, we deserve to finish second last year and we blew it on the final day. So with Spurs, you never quite know. But I'm more confident than I have been for quite a long time.
Excellent. Thank you very much to Martin. And we shall shift over now as well. And now over to Hull, another side that got a big win this weekend. We've got Les Motherby joining us from Amber Nectar fanzine. And Les, it's a serious, serious, serious 3 points, that one for Hull. It doesn't even pull them out of the relegation places. But what it does is that I think that a failure to win that one would possibly have consigned Hull over the course of the season. It certainly wouldn't have felt good. Whereas now Hull can look up and they can be optimistic and they can think they can get themselves out of this situation.
Yeah, I think it keeps us really having some realistic hope. I agree that if we had lost to Swansea on Saturday, although not massively down, I think we would have effectively been relegated. But now we can look at the teams above us and think, you know, if we play a bit better in the next couple of games, we could catch them. And quite frankly, it wasn't a good performance against Burnley. It was a turgid game of football between two teams that are petrified at the drop and they're almost paralysed. And the first bit of quality came after Mias came on a substitute, and that was the goal, and then he followed it up with another piece of quality. And you know, there wasn't any quality in the game until Mias came on a substitute, really.
Yeah, you mentioned the kind of lack of quality there, and I know the pitch didn't help as well. They shared it with the rugby team, which, you know, isn't a unique problem to Hull, but what you did have, which is, you know, doesn't happen a lot, which is the whole team played on the Friday night, and I think both teams kind of struggled with it, especially, you know, how Hull are trying to play at the moment. There's been a bit of a change of style under the new manager, and, you know, it didn't help to have that pitch having a rugby league game on the night before.
Which really didn't help, but it felt like a convenient excuse for two managers to explain a shocking performance. They certainly had the game looking at the pitch. It didn't look that bad. And if you could ignore the different coloured green paint that covered over the 10-yard line of the rugby pitch, from the start, it really didn't look that much of an issue. But I mean, I'm presuming the players would have mentioned it to the manager, so they've got more faith on experience. But, I mean, I despise the rugby team. I'm not a fan of rugby league. I wish they'd clear off. But it still just feels to me to be a little bit of excuse-making. It's easy to make from Marco Silva when he's the winning manager, but I suppose maybe there is something in it when Swansea's manager's saying the same thing too.
So Nias comes on, you said he makes the difference. It seemed to me, that from what I've seen, is just having an extra body up there, just more the change to two up front rather than anything particularly Nias was doing, just to give a bit more support and just a bit more of a threat, really, and something extra for Swansea to think about.
Exactly, and I think that's why Silva's talking about the pitch, because it deflects attention from why didn't you play three at the back and two up front from the beginning. It's not rocket science to put an extra body up and to be able to create more goal-scoring opportunities. It's something that really I think we should have done from the very, very start of the game. But we got it right eventually, and we got away with the win and a little bit of a Swansea comeback. So we'll just take the point and move on rather than ruminating on it. That should have been too much.
I think in terms of looking above, I mean, Neil made the point of, you know, the hope. I think part of the problem the Hull have got, obviously, is kind of The teams above them are doing pretty well as well. I mean, not everyone played this weekend, but you're looking at what's there. And I think, as much as anything, the Bournemouth result is a tough one for Hull, because you're looking at Leicester and the improvements they've made. Palace have improved, and you know, you're looking at that, but if Bournemouth would have lost that game, which could have well have happened, then it's almost become, well, they can be one we chase, but them getting the win is a bit of a blow for Hull, it feels to me anyway.
Everybody's tried for the new manager bounce at the bottom, with the exception of Sunderland. And, you know, we had that when Silver first came. Swansea had a bit of a turnaround initially when Clemens was there. And, you know, letting Ranieri go. Leicester have seen a bit of an upturn in form with Crenshaw being taken over temporarily. But you sort of think, ultimately, that will even itself out as a full season goes on. And for a bit of form, I'm not going to say you're going to need something a bit more than that.
You mentioned Nias at the weekend, and Nias's quality when he comes off the bench. Mm. It's in conjunction with Hernandez. Hernandez, you know, he's integral to promotion last season, but he's had his injury problems. Is he likely to stick with Hernandez now? Do you think Silva, if he can until the end of the campaign, use Nias off the bench a little bit, or do you think he's going to sort of pick the lad he thinks is going to do the best job for him? Because when I was watching Hernandez last season, I was quite consistently impressed with him, but as I say, he has been injury hit.
He's a material player, and there are some times when he doesn't look interested, and when he does, and I thought he had a bit of a moping about feeling certain and self quality on Saturday.
He was isolated, wasn't he?
And he looked frustrated at that before. I think that's the answer. You know, if you're going to play him, don't play him on his own. But I don't think we're going to get the best out of any forward playing on the run. So I would really, really hope we learn the lessons from Saturday and play too. And we can't blame Nias for Everton. He's on loan from them, so he's ineligible for Saturday. So
it becomes
who the second body is, because you've not got that option of
Nias
and Sterling all on the bench.
Okay, very quickly, do you think you're
going to
get out of this?
I'm not convinced. the Burnley performance frustrated me no end. Now, the problem with Hope is, you know, hopefully, a good thing in the shell shank redemption, but when you're following a struggling football club, hope is just going to hurt you in the long run. So hopefully.
Okay. Huge thank you to Les from Ember Nectar Fanzine. Me and John are going to have a little chat about the situation at the bottom right now. John, slightly difficult at times to hear Les there. Signal's a little bit in now, but you're right when you point out the impact of that Bournemouth result, really, because it's, you know, Swansea have looked like they're gonna put a run of form together. They look like they're in decent shape. So even they look like they can handle a defeat at Hull, is what I'm saying, to some extent, and it wouldn't surprise you if they got back on and found a way to get themselves another win. Palace are looking like they're beginning to sort themselves out. It'd be a shame for Hull if they come with a run, is what I'm saying. If they come with a run and just end up sort of finding the way to 35 to 38 points, and it's just not quite doing the job for them.
Yeah, I don't think Swansea will be too deterred by that result. It's not a great one for them. I'm sure they'd have been hoping to get the win, but I think there's still plenty of positives. So obviously how they played recently, the results they've been getting, and I think they probably think they'll do just enough, especially at home, to get safe. And so, yeah, I think if you're a whole, you're looking at that Bournemouth game, and especially when you watch it back and the way it kind of to and fro, just to think, well, you know, even a point there, might have thought we could kind of drag them into it, because the teams around have had the bounce that the kind of Les talked about there. And, you know, I mean, if it's even more desperate if you're the two below, because, you know, I mean, for Middlesbrough and Sunderland now, it's becoming trickier and trickier week by week, and they didn't even get to play, you know, in the league anyway. Yeah, I know Middlesbrough played the cup games, so it's getting trickier and trickier for them there. But, yeah, I mean, Hull, I think, you know, you're speaking to Les there, and I think he just wants to feel like they give it a good go. I don't think, quite often when you speak to teams who are down there, especially ones who've had experience of Championship, I don't think they necessarily see it as the be-all and end-all to be in the Premier League that we presumed they well, really. You know, I think, you know, because getting beat every week is not much fun and things like that anyway. And I think they just want to feel like the football club's going in the right direction. And, you know, there's a lot of issues around the ownership at Hull. I think they take going down and having a resolution to that ownership situation probably, and then feel like they can maybe grow from there. So, yeah, I think Les sounded a little bit resigned, but, you know, they've given themselves a chance. And I've noticed that the games coming up, what they've got, you know, there are a couple of winnable ones there for them. It's Everton away next, which isn't great, but then they've got two home games against West Ham and Middlesbrough. So, you know, if they can get 6 points there, then they're starting to think, well, maybe we could do something.
Every year, and Steve Goldsmith said this to me, every year people say, oh, the points total could be lower than ever this year. It could be 33. Whereas now you'd be surprised if it was 33 now, if you know what I mean. I think that every single year, sides do find a way. You mentioned two winnable games there for Hull. You know, if they do take 6 points from them, they're sitting there on 30 points.
Yeah.
Every year, you know, side, you just begin, when the pressure comes on, you begin to find a way to get a result in football matches. You wouldn't have thought Umarni Ass would be the man,
yeah,
for instance, the weekend, but he turns up and he scores a brace. You know, there's the resourcefulness, where necessity is the mother of invention, and all of a sudden you see these sides begin to find just a way to get results in football matches.
Yeah, problems within a football club, you know, tend to seem less important or go away. So if you've got a problem with the manager or a happy about a contract situation, I think, you know, when it's 2 months to fight for your lives, those things kind of go away, really. Defenders, you know, going in a little bit harder. And, you know, there's a lot's made of the fact that about contracts, player contracts now, and it's completely right. It should be, you know, if for some of these players, they'll be getting 40-50% reductions in,
yep,
in your wages. And I don't care how much money you're making, that's going to hurt. You know, people got a budget for things, they got mortgages and things like that. And so it's things that the football fans, players will be thinking about just from a purely selfish point of,
yep,
view. But also, you know, they don't want that relegation kind of on the CV, and they don't want to experience that together. They don't want to be staying there. So you will see more fight. You will see more togetherness. You'll see, you know, things, as I say, problems that won't go away but will be pushed aside for the necessity of trying to stay in the league. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think... Maybe there might be the team who comes 18th might actually end up with a pretty decent points total.
Last other game from the weekend was Everton versus West Brom. They were calling it the 7th place playoff before kickoff, and Everton winning it does actually make it a 7th place playoff. They're now 7 points clear of West Brom. Both got the same number of games played. Everton able to look a little bit ahead, and it does throw open, you know, it's something that maybe Evertonians should be optimistic about in a sense, even though they might not like the next sentence that comes. Everton do look like they look more like the bottom of a league of 7 than they do like their top of a league of 14, if you see what I mean.
I think they've got a good team. They've got players coming in. They've got a lot of young players coming through who they're rightly very excited about. You know, they're going to win the under-23s league this season, which is a great achievement when you consider how much the other clubs in the Northwest in particular are spending on their youth systems to go to win that. And, you know, they've got players coming through who look like they're going to be, you know, useful players for Koeman. I'm sure he's exactly aware of what he wants to do in the summer and kind of what he needs to do. And, you know, it all seems fairly achievable in terms of what they need to go out there and get. And so, yeah, if they can have a good summer, then I think they can look up. The problem that they've got, obviously, is similar to the one that Liverpool have got, is that other teams won't stand still and other teams will look to grow too. So, you know, will you see even more of a split between the bottom clubs and the top clubs next season? I think you probably will.
Indeed, and that has got to be the question for Evertonians moving forward. But right now, they can be pleased with that result of the weekend. West Brom do look ever so slightly like a side who might have down tools or just seen the limits of their ambition all season. They've struggled away from home against the sides that are above them. That's been our 50-50 football show this week. Thank you to all of our callers. It was fantastic to get them all on, Asam, Martin and Les. And thank you very much to me and John as well, obviously, because we deserve all the credit in the world. Hope you've had a lovely weekend. Look forward to the Champions League game this weekend, and we'll be looking forward to next weekend on Thursday. See you in a bit.